Can't relate.
There was a place in the ghetto called the bank, and the people who had some valuables, fur coats, silverware, watches, anything like that, could go there and sell it. And we were supposed to do it. And because of my fear of the cripple, I decided one day that I would take all the watches, and I had some silver cutlery and two fur coats, and I took everything. I could hardly lift. I went twice. I took a sack of watches, which was maybe 100 weight, and I took all that to the bank, and I got a few thousand marks, which was not even 1% what I would have received on the black market. But by then I was terrified of going onto the black market in case I thought I was being followed by somebody. And I had some reason I think I was correct in that, because a man would sort of appear on the staircase. I lived right on top of the building, as if he was watching me and going behind me, watching me and following me. And I thought, well, if he works for someone who works for the cripple, I'll be in trouble. And one day, when I came back from the post office, I noticed the green van, which was the cripple van with a driver, standing outside our block of flats. And I was afraid to go home. I didn't stay that night. I didn't stay at home. I walked until after midnight. Eventually I came home, and I noticed that my neighbor's door was smashed, and he was taken to the cripple. That was the last straw. I thought either they were after me, and whoever gave the information mentioned the wrong door or the wrong number, and there was some confusion. And then I thought the best thing is to take everything to this bank and sell it, get the receipt for it, and then I can say, yes, I did have some watches and other things, and I've sold everything to Rumkowski's bank. And Gershovsky, whom was my father's friend, was the head of the bank, and I met him. He was a bit surprised that I had so much silver. And I said, well, it was my uncle's, and he left it behind, and now I'm selling it. It was rather late, because I should have sold it a year earlier, or according to the posters. But since then, my fear of the cripple sort of was less than prior to that.
What happened to the goods when you sold them to the bank?
Well, I still, for that money, I could still buy extra soups and extra bread, but was so little that it ran out very quickly.
Where would the goods go?
To the Germans.
But it was Rumkowski's bank.
Yes, but Rumkowski was collecting it for the Germans. Everything went to the Germans.
Did people not resent Rumkowski and the Judenrat? Did they not see them as collaborators?
Some did. Majority, I would say many did, and some did not. Had he survived, he would have been murdered after the war. Or had he, as it happened, he was killed in Auschwitz. But indirectly, because of him, more people survived the Lodz ghetto than any other ghetto. Not the ones he meant to survive, not he himself, his family, and his friends, but people like myself. The ghetto lasted longer, although my younger sister died of TB in the ghetto. My younger brother died of typhoid. He was making lists of people. he did collaborate, but would you accuse the British soldier, British, who were building the bridge on the River Kwai, or that, would you accuse them of collaboration? What about the millions of Russian prisoners of war who did exactly what they were told?
And the point I was trying to get at was, did the Jewish people in the ghetto resent him? Did they regard him as a collaborator?
Not as a collaborator. The people whom he put on the list because they were not working obviously resented and hated him. The people who, because of him, survived a bit longer were very grateful to him. I'm talking about Cherniakov who was in the same position in the Warsaw ghetto. Now when the curfew took place in the more or less at the same time, the Warsaw ghetto was being liquidated. Cherniakov committed suicide. Now, and he's somehow, no one blames him for collaboration. He took poison and killed himself. But who had poison? And what would you think of a captain of a ship who, when the ship is about to sink, takes poison or jumps overboard? I don't think that would, you know, it's impossible to judge. Indirectly, few thousand people survived who would not have survived otherwise. But his, Rumkowski's, idea, hope, was that instead of 250,000, maybe 50,000 will survive, and in those 50,000 there will be the handful of his immediate friends and he himself. That's how I would judge him, but I'll...
Did people in the Lodz ghetto, during this curfew, did you know what was happening in the Warsaw ghetto? Did you have any rumours, information?
Yes, a little later, yes, we knew. We knew that all the ghettos were being liquidated.
How did you know this?
The letters used to come before, and in the autumn 1944, all correspondence stopped at the post office. It was obvious there's no one, there was no more postcards or any letters or any communications from the hundreds of little ghettos.
Were people
beginning And there were rumors that the ghettos are being liquidated.
Were people still unaware as to what was happening to the people who were being taken out of the ghetto? Or were people aware by this time of the camps?
I don't think people were aware. Well, we knew that hundreds of thousands were perishing. That was obvious, that they were being shot. We didn't know about Auschwitz. We didn't know that there were actually places where people were being gassed, but we didn't think that those who were evacuated were still alive.
During the whole time of the ghetto, was there any social life? What did people do in the evenings?
There was a theatre in the ghetto, and I went once to the theater, and there were songs and dances, and but I decided not to do it anymore because it brought back memories and it unsettled you. And although I enjoyed it very much, the singing, the dancing, and the various variety performance, I cannot judge the standard. I thought it was marvelous. But I realized that it made me suffer more, and it's dangerous to indulge in such things. And I wouldn't go again. This was only once that I went there.
Was it Jewish actors and...
Jewish actors, yes, and Jewish audience. And there were singers in the street. There was one singer who was singing in Yiddish songs that he composed about the ghetto, about Rumkowski. And there were singers in the streets.
In an evening?
No, during the day.
Like buskers?
No, in the evening there was. You were not allowed to go out after dark. I could go out.
When would?
Well, the curfew was late. Later, it wasn't so bad. It wasn't so. You could go out a little longer, but there was no social life as such. There were no restaurants, no cafeterias. There were. There was nothing.
Would people gather at each other's flats?
I don't know. I met my friends. Well, most of my friends were at the post office. But you didn't gather in the evening. No, you were tired. It was a matter of going to sleep. And you were hungry all the time.
Did your sister survive the ghetto?
No, she died after I was sent away. I found out about it after the war.
Were there any underground organisations in the ghetto?
Not as far as I'm aware of. There was one of my friends had a radio. Now that was up. The most dangerous thing to do. But he knew what was going on and listened to the radio.
He knew what was going on in the war?
In the war, yes. Which listening to the broadcast from London or from the Russian front or from the German radio and so on. So we knew what was going on. But of course, possessing a radio was very, very extremely risky, extremely dangerous.
Can you describe now the events leading up to your own evacuation from the ghetto?
Yes, after the Sperra, the curfew, which was in September 1942, every month or so, Rumkowski was asked by the Germans to provide 500 men or 1,000 men or 500 women and so on to be sent out of the ghetto. Because almost everybody was working by now, he had to make lists of those who were less needed. In his opinion, the post office began to employ girls. So when I first joined the post office, the postmen and the messengers were mainly boys and men. By 1943, there were half girls and half men. And towards the end of 1943, at the beginning of December, actually the winter of 1943, I together with most of the men who worked at the post office were put on one of the lists. And we had to report to the police stations in order to be sent out. Like everybody else, we went into hiding. Nobody wanted to be sent out from the ghetto. And we went into hiding. And the girls helped us because our food was immediately, food rations were immediately
stopped.
And we didn't have any food at all. the girls at the post office began to help us. It worked for a week or maybe 2 weeks.
Where did you hide?
We hid in the places where the girls lived. We slept. There was more accommodation by then in the ghetto, because the population was reduced to maybe 80,000 or 90 because of the death. Then the posters began to appear that those who help, those who are supposed to be evacuated, will also be sent out of the ghetto. So the girls were afraid. They would only hide the boyfriend, but not those that were not their boyfriends. I didn't have a girlfriend at the time, and I realized that I have to fend for myself. I was hiding in the cellar of the block of flats where I lived, but the cold was unbearable. The temperature was minus 10 degrees, minus 15 degrees. This was Christmas 1943. Then my sister was taken as a hostage because they couldn't find me. So,
how did you know this?
When I went back to the room, and the neighbors told me, so I found out that she was taken. And this was known, that the family of those who are hiding will be taken as hostages. I then went to Gershovsky, who was close to Rumkowski, and asked him if he could help me. And I got soup from his wife. I was very hungry by then. And he said that unfortunately he cannot help me anymore because Rumkowski is now unapproachable, and there is nothing can be done about it. I then decided to go back and sleep in my room. And at 10 o'clock my sister came back. They released her. So I thought that they have already found the 1,000 or 2,000 men that they needed, and therefore I am safe now, because that's what happened very often. But 2 hours later, there was a knock on the door, and 2 policemen came in looking for me. I hid under the bed, but they were again going to take my sister as a hostage. So I came out and I said, "Don't take her, I'm here." They didn't search even the place, even under the bed.
Is this Jewish police?
Jewish policeman. And that was already after midnight, and they arrested me, and they were taking me to the police station.
How did your sister react?
Well, we simply said goodbye, and I said I saw her later. She cried when they wanted to take her as a hostage, so she was in tears.
You were taken to the police
station? I was taken to the police station, and I didn't take many of my things, or anything of my, my jackets and other, only what I was wearing. And as we were walking, this was after midnight. Yeah, just after midnight. Very cold, severe frost, and I knew the area very well, and I could easily have run away, because they were men of 35, 40, 2 men. They didn't have any guns. Jewish policemen didn't have any weapons. But then I thought, well, if I run away, they will go and take my sister away. What is the point? And then I was quite friendly with them, because they said, well, who knows who is better off? Are we better off because we are remaining in the ghetto for a little longer? Or are you better off because you will be sent away somewhere? So there was this uncertainty. We arrived at the police station and I was fed good soup and I was taken to the cell, which was a large room with banks, with timber, wooden banks. But there were only two men. Although the cell seemed big enough for 20, there were only two other men. And there was fire, there was a stove, one of those cast iron stoves that you feed. And one of the men was breaking the banks because there was not enough coal, breaking the wood and feeding it into the stove. And we stayed up all night talking. One of them was very quiet, but the other one was Oizer. And we exchanged our sort of life stories. And his was extremely interesting because he escaped from the Lodz ghetto in 1940, a few months after the creation of the ghetto. He went with a smuggler. He wanted to go to the Warsaw ghetto. He, his younger cousin, together with some 20 people, who paid a lot of money to a Jewish smuggler who was going to take them across the border into the Polish territory. And then in those days it was still feasible. And they were supposed to go through the Jewish cemetery, go over the wall and be on the other side. But somehow they were denounced and the Germans were waiting for the party and they shot everybody except him. He managed to run away and another man fainted. And after that he decided to run away on his own to the Warsaw ghetto. And he managed, it's the only case that I know of a successful escape from the Lodz ghetto. And he managed to go through the border. It's a long story, but I don't want to go into it in detail. And he went to the Warsaw ghetto. When the Warsaw ghetto was being liquidated, he ran away again into all the sort of small ghettos, from one to the other. And he saw that everyone was being evacuated, and he managed to run away, and eventually he fell in love with a girl in one of the small ghettos. And because of that, he didn't run away, but he was on a train going to Treblinka. This was the first time I heard the word Treblinka. And he managed, after a few days, he managed to jump off the train just before Treblinka, and he made his way back to the Lodz ghetto. And he managed to come back. It was the unique case. I don't think anybody, he was the only one who's done that. But because his sister was Rumkowski's secretary, he was not handed over to the Kripo, and he got a very good job in a kitchen. But because of his character, he robbed the kitchen, a sack of flour and some other. Not that he needed it, but it was in his nature to do such things. And because of it, he was arrested, and he was now on the same transport as I was. And that night we became friends, and we sort of teamed up. Then they took us to Marysin, to the main prison, where we spent quite a few weeks. I was in a cell, which was a room, maybe smaller than this one, maybe 18 feet by 18. There were 30 men.
Were you still with this friend?
I was not in the same cell. No, not in Marishin. But later I joined.
What was his name?
Oizer Walfisch. And his sister, Walfiszówna, was Rumkowski's secretary.
Did he know what was happening in
Czechoslovakia? He did, because when he jumped off the train and he was going through the Polish countryside near there, the Poles told him what happened. Train after train goes there and no one comes back. And there's smoke coming up and they're killing everybody there.
What was your reaction to this information?
Well, by then, I wasn't surprised by then, because it wasn't something entirely new. You were, at the back of your mind, you knew you were sentenced to death from the first moment. But he said, sooner or later, they will try to kill us all, and therefore, in the last moment, you have to run away to escape. Those were his words. Anyway, when we were in the cell in Marishin, we were well fed, and somehow we knew we were going to a labor camp because we were young men and they were feeding us well. So we were not so afraid. But there was one case where a man jumped from a window and broke his leg. And that was a day before we were sent out. This was already the beginning of March 1944. The 3rd of March 1944. And there was sort of silence in our room, and one of the men, he was the big fellow, strong, sort of loud. It was like as if we had a party. People were telling jokes and laughing. And in spite of the crowded condition, it was better than it was kind of a rest. You didn't work, you didn't do anything. You were fed quite well. You were lying on the floor. But you were not sort of uncomfortable. It's strange to imagine it. And suddenly he burst out crying, and that was very unnerving, because we looked at him and said, "Pavel, what's the matter? You know, why are you crying?" So he says, "Well, at least he will..." Yeah, because somebody said, "For that I have always time to kill myself. What's the hurry? There is always time." And he burst out crying and said, "At least his family will know where he is buried," because we were near the Jewish cemetery. Lodz has a huge Jewish cemetery. And then he said, "At least he will not die like a dog and be buried under a fence." And 4 months later, that's precisely what happened to him when we were in the camp.